Okay, hi, that's loud. Welcome to our panel discussion about the Taiwan elections 2020. My name is William A. Callahan. I'm a professor here at the London School of Economics in the IR department. Just wanted to thank LSE Ideas for arranging this. And they have told me that what they really appreciate is either during or towards the end of the show tonight, fill out their form so they can kind of know, get some interesting information from you, especially how you rate this event. You can probably circle 5 for that right now, just because it is going to be excellent. That's a good sort of segue. We're really, really happy and honored to have 3 experts on Taiwan and the Asia Pacific here to talk about the elections. The first person who's going to speak is my colleague, Professor Christopher Hughes, also of the International Relations Department, who's an expert on Taiwan and China and the international politics of the Asia Pacific. Next person who'll speak is Michael Riley, who's the former ambassador to Taiwan, if I can say that. I would like to say that. Former head of the British office in Taipei, the de facto ambassador to Taiwan for the British government. The third speaker is Mr. Gideon Rockman, who is a well-known FT columnist with the Financial Times and has a book that is relevant to our discussion tonight, War and Peace in the 21st Century. So what each of these panelists is going to do is speak for about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll start a conversation. This is a round table, even though it's actually 2 circles. And then we will have a little discussion amongst ourselves, not amongst ourselves, but amongst the panelists. And then what we'll do is we'll open it up to questions. So please, if any questions are raised, remember them. Someone will go around with a microphone during the Q&A. And when you're asking a question, I'll say this again later, when you're asking a question, please identify yourself. The proceedings are going to be recorded, or are being recorded, I should say. We're not sure if they're going to be posted on the web. We have to actually make sure that we're all happy with what we've said before we give permission. That's my understanding. But with no further ado, I ask my colleague Chris Hughes to come in and share
some. So we're going to put up this mic.
Yeah, I've got to pass off the mic.
Okay. Good evening, everybody. And I've been following Taiwan's elections since they began in the early 1990s. Seems like a long time now, but of course, it's still a very young democracy. And January 11th, the elections, which are not just for the president, but also for parliament, remember. It's always a very exciting time in Taiwan. I mean, elections could be happening to Taiwanese elections. It's really festive occasion, isn't it? And really exciting. Much more exciting than the elections here, should I say. But also, of course, a lot hangs on them. Not just for Taiwan itself, but of course for the regional order, for China, and of course ultimately for the whole world, given Taiwan's geostrategic location. I think it's worth bearing in mind that for most people in Taiwan, the elections are not necessarily about China, they're about other issues, more boring issues of domestic politics and so on, but we're going to focus, I think, on the international implications. So give them a few questions to talk about. And the first one was really looking at the People's Republic of China and what they're looking for in these elections. So I think there's a very simple answer to this. The PRC would love the KMT to win the presidency and parliament and return to what's called the 1992 consensus, this kind of vague agreement that there's one China that is supposed to go back to the first meetings in 1992. However, the opinion polls show that that is very unlikely, that signing when the incumbent is well ahead in the opinion polls. And certainly since things got bad in Hong Kong in July and August. She's taking a big leave of the team. So I would guess that if they're being realistic in Beijing, their best hope is to try, is to accept that they will have a PPP president, but hope that they get a KMT majority in the parliament. And that would kind of bind the president's hands, not completely, but that would be a bit similar to what happened with the previous PPP president, Chen Shui-bian, between 2000 and 2008. And people forget that he never had a parliamentary majority, so he was always constrained by the way that the PRC try and appeal both his head to the KMT and other parties in parliament. So that's probably their best outcome, being looking at the opinion polls. And that's important because the parties are actually neck and neck in the parliamentary elections, about 28% each in the opinion polls. And that means there are small parties, at least three small parties, who could hold the balance of power. And some of those can easily be won over by Beijing. So they have that hope, and I would guess that's going to be their strategy, to try and, you know, get a majority, not just as many KMT MPs, but also appeal to these small parties, which can be done under the voting system in Taiwan, which has to sort of be asked. I won't go into the details, but there's a real possibility to do that. So that might be possible, given that there is some discontent with the DPP over issues like pension reform, in particular, which were well overdue, and I think the DPP deserves credit for seeing them through, but it created some negative feelings. So there's a real chance that there could be a DPP president and a sort of blue dominated parliament. However, that's not for sure. You know, there could be a DPP parliament too. Taiwan's economy is pretty good at the moment, shows solid growth, benefiting partly from the US-China trade war, relocation of industries back from China to Taiwan. So, you know, who knows what will happen. But I think, in a sense, what Beijing needs to be doing is planning for what happens after the election. Because either of these scenarios is not good for them, because they will have a DPP president, and that's not what they want. So how will they look at the post-election scenario? And I think that's really, maybe if I was in Beijing, I'd be planning for that, thinking, the DPP, when it had power before, in its second term, Chen Shui-bian's second term, it fell apart. There was a lot of factional division, there was problems of corruption. It's very hard to maintain discipline in the DPP, and it has a lot of different sort of broad church factional party. So how could they manipulate that situation after the election? That's where I think they will be focusing on. And they'll need to very carefully assess the balance of power in the DPP itself and try to manipulate that in its favor. In particular, because Tsai Ing-wen's presidential candidate, her runner-up, Lai Ching-te, is much more than a pro-independence leading side. So that will send a signal to them that the DPP could move further towards a more adventurous independence platform, and they'll want to try and stop that somehow. Now, I don't know quite how they'll do that, especially because China's room for maneuver is much more constrained now than it was in the 2000s under Chen Shui-bian. It became quite unpopular due to corruption in particular. But at the moment, public opinion in Taiwan has shifted well away from China towards identifying solely as Taiwanese, particularly with the new generation coming into politics, and particularly with generation change and then seeing what's happening in Hong Kong. So that's going to be difficult for them to do the same kind of thing that they did in the 2000s when they won over. They did a kind of deal with the KMT, both the DPP's head, and maneuvered them out of power in 2008. I think the biggest fear for China, though, always is not so much the DPP for a known quantity, but what will happen to the KMT if and when it loses. The biggest fear is if the KMT actually decides to move more towards a sort of pro-Taiwan, pro-independence, identifying the Taiwan platform, then Beijing has really lost the game, because their only real strategy to achieve what they want is to deliver the kind of team work with them as they did in the 2000s. So that's a problem, I think, because and I would be watching very carefully what happens to the KMT if they lose again and they don't do well. They really have, they need to change, and they can't go on with this sort of pro-China unification, three principles of the people platform. And in fact, my joke, he only won his election in 2008 for the KMT by moving quite a long way towards identifying as Taiwanese, which he then rolled back on losing power and lost favor and lost the election. After that, the sign went. So, you know, the KMT still hasn't resolved this problem, its own identity, its own loyalty, and how it's perceived, especially by the voters. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure on within the party. And you look at the kind of candidates they're choosing for their, you know, elections, and a lot of them are really old Chinese nationalists. It's not helping. So they're beginning to lose favor even now in opinion polls, because they're trying to identify clearly with Taiwan. So I think that, Beijing has two problems. One is sort of containing the DPP, the other is even more important in the sense of trying to hold on to what's left of the KMT and make sure they don't drift too far towards the sort of green area of politics with the native Taiwanese. So I think, in a sense, Beijing's hands are really tied. They're in a dilemma. It's the old dilemma that goes back to the beginning of democratization of if they give more space to Taiwan and kind of take the pressure off in order to give the KMT some help, then the Taiwanese will run with that. You know, say, great, there's no pressure, let's push for more recognition in international space. But if they put pressure on Taiwan, then it will alienate people even more. So, you know, that and people will vote for the DPP, we've seen this in the past. So, whichever way they turn, they returned to the dilemma they thought they solved with Ma Ying-jeou, but it turned out that they hadn't. Of, you know, getting more space is not what doesn't work, and putting pressure on doesn't either. How am I doing for time?
3 minutes.
Okay, because I had a whole load of questions here, and I've only answered one of them. The second one was about what's the likely response in terms of foreign and security policy to the possible election outcomes. And I guess if the DPP win, we will see continuity from China, continued slow strangulation, economic, cultural, diplomatic, current diplomatic allies. But again, that goes back to the dilemma, because that hasn't helped. You know, it hasn't taken away support from the DPP. So if they continue with that, it won't help. What about the military option? I'm sure everyone's thinking about this. And we always say it's unlikely. And I think it is always unlikely because the cost of this is just so hard to calculate and unacceptable. I think the only conditions under which that might happen would be something dramatic happening inside China itself with the Communist Party leadership. It's not impossible, of course, because it seems that big things are happening in the Communist Party. But that's not what we're talking about today. I don't think it would come from, you know, but ruling that out, we will see continuity of this sort of status quo. Might also depend on signals from Washington. This could really heighten the risk of some military action because of the really collapse of decision making and the administration in Washington. I didn't realize quite how serious that was until I had to prepare a lecture on North Korea this week and realized just how dysfunctional Washington has become in dealing with North Korea. I mean, people must be to really almost led to a nuclear war last year and the year before. So, you know, those are not good. That's not a good context to have this kind of election in. Everyone needs to be very careful about the calculations they make. If the KMT wins, then I guess it's a return to the old policy of more contacts, a return to negotiations that have been frozen by the DPP is in power, and expansion of trade and investment. But if that goes ahead, China needs to be very careful to calibrate that, much more carefully than they did under Ma Ying-jeou, because the policy fell under Ma, went too fast, lack of transparency. People got worried about penetration, economic penetration, media control, these kind of issues. And this is very high on the agenda at the moment in Taiwan. It's been blocked in the last few days. Professor Yun Shi in particular, a very interesting article about how the PRC is getting control of the media in Taiwan. So if that moves ahead too fast, you know, it will end in a few, again, you can well have the kind of another suburb coming up on the streets. So they need to be very careful about how fast they move, and that means understanding Taiwanese public opinion and party politics, not just on the KMT side, which is always a Chinese problem. They go to Taiwan, they talk to these blue politicians, these KMT people, and they haven't got a clue about how the Taiwanese really think. Because they don't talk to them, they don't like them, they're not, you know, pro-China. And now that's really a problem that they've got to overcome to understand the whole spectrum of politics if they're going to make their sort of united front policy work in any kind of way. Otherwise it's going to backfire. I've still got two more questions. Maybe I should finish on that one. I don't know how I'm doing for time.
Okay.
Should I finish there? The other one was on the implications of Taiwan's foreign policy.
Let's do that during the discussion.
I think we can leave that, yeah. Okay.
So, Michael Riley.
Thank you, Bill, and good evening, everybody. As Chris said in his opening remarks, we were each given a series of exam questions, so I'll try to answer. Mine was to consider Taiwan's global position in the context of the election and its aftermath. Inevitably, I think there's going to be some overlap with what Chris said, if only because of the overwhelming importance of China in Taiwanese thinking and in other areas too. Now, I guess if Taiwanese are looking at their global standing, their global position in the world in the run-up to the election, there are lots of reasons for them to feel pretty depressed. First point is Taiwan's probably the most trade-dependent country in the world. Its trade-GDP ratio is about 130. To put it in context, Korea's is about 100. The only countries that have got higher ratios are city-states like Singapore and Hong Kong. But at the moment, the global trade environment clearly is very uncertain. The US-China trade war inevitably is affecting Taiwan. There's an Asian proverb, when whales hunt, shrimps get hurt. Well, I'm sure a lot of Taiwanese feel that's the case with them at the moment. Because it's equal over focus of all the coverage from the trade war is very much on China. It's easy to overlook how dependent China actually is on Taiwanese companies for its own prosperity. Eight of the top 11 Chinese exporting companies are Taiwanese owned. And while China is Taiwan's largest export market, meaning half of all its exports to China, 45%, are going into Taiwanese owned factories and other foreign factories where they're put into final assembly for export to other countries, predominantly the USA. So it's affecting that. This feeds into wider economic uncertainty. And on top of that, as Chris mentioned, you've got the uncertainty that there are watching protests in Hong Kong with ever more dismay and concern. On top of the trade wars, there's a real fear in Taiwan that because of Chinese pressure, they will be excluded from any regional trade agreements, or that China will stop them from being able to negotiate any significant bilateral trade agreements. And if that wasn't enough, China continues to squeeze its ever-diminishing international space. We've seen in recent months, Taiwan's lost two more of its diplomatic allies, and as Chris said, based on past practice, I think it's reasonable to assume that if Tsai Ing-wen gets re-elected, still more will be lost through Chinese persuasion, pressure, bribery, or a combination of them. As I'm sure you all know, the squeeze is a lot more than just diplomatic recognition. Just look at any airline website and see how airlines describe Taiwan nowadays. Again, as Chris said, this makes no strategic sense from China's point of view. All the previous evidence is that all this does is harden attitudes in Taiwan. So why is China doing it? Partly because of power, but more because China's foreign policy is driven overwhelmingly by domestic considerations And the Communist Party needs to show its domestic audience, if you like, in China, that it's reacting to events in Taiwan. Because I think it fears that if it isn't seen to be doing so, it would be perceived to be weak. Okay, that's all the party views. Are there any reasons to be cheerful? Well, actually, I think there are quite a few. Firstly, the Taiwanese economy is very resilient, despite the global uncertainty. 2019 export volumes look as if they'll be slightly down on last year, about 1.25%. But the consensus at the moment, or the money forecast for GDP growth, is looking at about 2.4% growth for this year. Now, by Taiwanese historic standards, that may sound pretty anemic, and I'm sure there's a lot of opposition politicians will be saying that in the election campaign. But again, if you put it into a wider context, that's higher than the IMF is forecasting for Korea, the same 2%, a lot higher than the forecasting for Singapore, 0.5%, higher than for Japan, less than 1%. We don't even need to go to Hong Kong, which is already in a technical recession. So on a regional basis, and indeed on a global basis, Taiwan is actually looking at a pretty good growth this year. Second reason to be cheerful, it's still a member of the World Trade Organization, and China is not going to be able to do anything about that. Now, okay, multilateral trade negotiations in the WTO made history, but that makes it easy to overlook just what is still going on in the WTO in sectoral areas. There's one example, Taiwan is a member of the Information Technology Agreement. This actually covers 95% of world trade in IT products, in which, of course, Taiwan is the world leader. It's also a member of the Trade and Services Agreement, negotiated in international service agreements. China isn't a member of that. But it also argued that actually, loss of diplomatic recognition is much less of a blow to Taiwan now than it was in the past. The harsh reality is that most of its remaining diplomatic allies are microstates. And while it needs to retain a core group to ensure its voice gets heard in the United Nations and elsewhere, most Taiwanese, what is probably more important has been the steady expansion in visa-free travel over the last 8 to 9 years. I think it's very easy to underestimate, but we shouldn't, the psychological importance for Taiwanese and the ability to visit so many countries of the world on a Taiwanese passport without the need for a visa. And that's a marked contrast to what ordinary Chinese have to go through to get a visa. The reality is that despite this compensation, Taiwan is actually one of the most globalized countries in the world, and that has made it highly adaptable and very resilient. But it's a drawback as well as a plus, because the benefits have not been spread widely. Really, for most Taiwanese, have largely stagnated for most of this century, hence the rise of populism, just as here and in the USA and elsewhere. And while companies have moved some production back to Taiwan from China to avoid trans tariffs, the real beneficiary of the US-China trade war has been Vietnam. As of September, its exports to the US were up 21% year on year. China's in the first half of the year were down 12%. And by one estimate, Vietnam's economy could be boosted 7%, GDP could be boosted 7% as a result of the trade war. The problem with Taiwanese politicians is that much of this investment and export growth in Vietnam is actually coming from Taiwanese companies relocating to Vietnam rather than to Taiwan. Now, there's an answer there, which is more than what will happen to Taiwan, because there are deep-seated structural difficulties that inhibit them from doing so, that the politicians of both parties might talk about, but so far have done actually very little around addressing. This inevitably is a bigger worry for Tsai Ing-wen and for the KMT, not least because she fought successfully the last presidential campaign on domestic issues, but there's a strong perception that she's failed to deliver. And that could affect the DPP this time, although they could argue that all this investment in Vietnam is actually a success for their new southbound policy. That said, as Chris has pointed out, the KMT faces a bigger problem. Quite apart from what's going on in Hong Kong, US-China relations are more antagonistic now than they have been at any time in the last 40 years. Taiwanese companies are going to be very, very wary about getting caught in the crossfire of that. So they're going to hedge their bets, It's not at all obvious that most of them would wish to increase investment in China in current circumstances. Indeed, we're already seeing the US putting pressure on companies like TSMC to stop supplying Huawei, for example. So, the second question was, what might Taiwan do post-election to secure its interests in an uncertain world? Well, I don't need to say too much about China, Chris has covered that. But reiterate or emphasize what he said, even if the KMT were to win the election, there's actually very little scope for major change. It's not at all clear that the Trump administration would welcome improved Asian Taipei relations, and Taipei can't afford to bring in the USA. But the real problem, if the KMT win, is that Xi Jinping wants to move beyond discussion about trade, about investment, to political discussions between the two sides. And that remains completely unacceptable to domestic public opinion in Taiwan. And I don't see that changing in at least 10 years, if indeed ever, certainly while Xi Jinping is in power. On the other hand, if the GDP win, I think we can assume no real change. We expect to see the new Southbound policy continue. Expected to maintain its close but discreet relationship with Japan, good relations with the US to continue, irrespective of who wins the 2020 election in the US. I think one thing that this DPP administration has learned very clearly from the mistakes of the Chen-Shui-bian one is the importance of not antagonizing Washington, and they have successfully built up good all-party cross-party support in Washington for the position. But a bigger question surrounds trade policy, which is actually also more relevant to Taiwan's global position. Both the current DPP and the previous Ma Ying-jeou KMT administrations said that joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, was a priority for them. That said, neither has actually shown much sign at all of implementing the domestic structural reforms that would be necessary for Taiwan's to join. Now, the TPP is dead in the water. Trump pulled the US out. It's been replaced by the Comprehensive Program, Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP, run by the Japanese. Now the USA, but we like some of the trade liberalization policies that the USA has insisted on as a price for accession. That should actually make it easier for Taiwan to join. The reforms would have to implement less of a facing. And logically, accession should be a priority for any Taiwanese government. It represents less hope of joining a significant contract trading group. And while, if you look at the membership of the CPTPP, take out Japan, and it doesn't look to be particularly large, it still represents the third largest multilateral trading bloc there is at the moment. And Prime Minister Abe has got this ambition to align it with the EU-Japan Free Trade Agreement. If that were to happen, it would become by far the biggest multilateral trading bloc. And so Taiwan really needs to get into it, and it helps that most of the members there are relatively sympathetic. They share critical values for Taiwan, so it's probably very good. Probably easier for the DPP government to achieve simply because its relations with Japan are always easier than those of the KMT. The problem is that we see little of the sign in the campaign, either with any concerted thought through diplomatic campaign to persuade other members to allow them to join, or any domestic preparation in terms of structural reform to actually ease the path towards joining. Looking at Europe, whoever wins in Taipei, I have to say, I don't see any real change in attitudes towards either Europe or the UK. The reality is that Europe doesn't really feature very highly on the Taiwanese thinking. It doesn't provide the security guarantees that the USA does. And while there's lots of rhetoric about the way trade has grown and all the exchanges have happened, in reality, trade growth has been very, very modest. The last of the outgoing EU Trade Commissioner, Cecilia Malmström, did announce that the EU would be willing to look at an investment agreement with Taiwan, but there's been almost no sign that the Commission bureaucrats have actually been willing to take any action at all on this. And as for the UK, I think the harsh reality is that the relationship is not as important as either side may like to think. Bilateral trade has barely increased in 20 years. Taiwan does more trade with the Netherlands than it does with the UK. There's very little Taiwanese investment in the UK. Most of what there is not single market focused, so it's not going to be affected by Brexit. Why do they need to have a dramatic referendum? I think there's a lot of hope in Taipei that this might, a UK outside the EU might actually forge a new relationship with Taiwan, being a signed free trade agreement. I think the last 3 years have shown the Taiwanese, like most of the rest of the world, that actually most of the Brexit is for is no more about just empty rhetoric, not based on reality. And assuming Brexit does go ahead, the harsh reality is negotiating a new relationship with the EU is going to occupy all of the UK's capacity. So there may be scope in the margins, one or two more new agreements for Taiwan, but nothing more than that. I think my time's up. So thank you.
Okay. Gideon Rockwell.
Okay, thank you. Well, as far as I recall from the questions we sent, I was asked to talk mainly about the kind of international aspect of this, particularly how the Taiwanese elections will be regarded in Washington and Beijing, and how that will affect the interactions between the US and China. And thinking about this made me feel rather old, because the first time I began to pay attention to this issue was 1995, 96, the Taiwan Straits crisis. At that time, I was editing the Economist's Asia paper, and I remember going to a conference at Dixie Park, which is where they have kind of grand conferences in this country on foreign affairs, and it was being attended by Joe Nye, who I think was at that point in time US Assistant Secretary of State for the Navy. I mean, he's an eminent Harvard professor, but like a lot of these people, kind of moved in and out of government. And again, without, I'm pretty sure that Nye said, this was in the build-up of the crisis, that the one thing America should not do was send an aircraft carrier to the Taiwan Strait. But I guess it was overruled, because they did that then a couple of weeks later. And that was a really important moment, I think probably a defining moment in the relationship between the US and China, and particularly, obviously, over the Taiwan issue. Because I think the lesson that both sides drew afterwards was that that China had been forced to back down, that America had displayed a willingness to use deterrence and military deterrence in the Pacific, that even some of the Pentagon, as Alexander suggests, had hesitated about, but they had in the end sent the carrier, and the Chinese kind of display of force pulled back there. But I think it's not been a static situation since then, because obviously China is now a much larger economy, has poured money into the military and poured money into the Navy since then. And a big question in the mind of both Washington and Beijing is, okay, if you have another Taiwan Straits crisis, would the US behave in the same way? Would China be deterred in the same way? And, you know, one of these things that strategists like to discuss, I've certainly heard people in China itself, in Shanghai and so on, some of these institutes say, look, we think the next time there's a crisis, America would not respond because the balance of power has shifted. And they would be too scared, for example. But again, the American line is that they definitely would respond. Again, deterrence is still attempting to, it's still there. Again, reminds me of another incident where I saw this up quite close, was in 2007, where I managed to sort of attach myself to a delegation of American and European semi-government officials, or people who were about to go into government, which is very useful to the journalists, because they have much better access than I was ever going to get. So we went as part of this delegation to the Ministry of Defense in Beijing, And it was a very formal occasion, quite interesting to witness. You know, there was a bunch of Chinese generals in their uniforms sitting opposite a bunch of Americans who were about to go into the Obama administration. Some of them did indeed do that. And the formal statement by the Chinese said, you know, that Taiwan is a core national interest, that the phrase they used, and you know, if Taiwan were ever to declare independence, we would invade, basically. And the really interesting part after that was that the American leading the delegation, the guy called Walt Slocum, who was a former Secretary of the Pentagon, said, you know, in a rather understate way, well, I'm very sorry to hear that, because if you did that, you would be at war with the United States. when I wrote the book that was referred to, which is called Easternization, I thought, you know, like enough time to elapse 8 years later, I can use it. So I did it. But before I did it, I checked and I rang Walt Slocum and said, did I remember that incident correctly? You know, is that what you said? And he said, you know, I can't remember, but it's certainly what I would have said. So I said, okay, fine, that's confirmation. And used the anecdote, nobody's ever contradicted me, but it was interesting sort of to see deterrence in action and this rather sort of formal statements or positions by both sides. Now, of course, neither side knows whether the other one is serious or is bluffing, but they're kind of laying out positions. And that is the position that that the Americans want, that the Chinese position is, as they've said many times, that if Taiwan were to declare independence or to be seen to be moving towards independence, they reserve the right to invade. And the American position, although complex in law, what they actually say in private is we would respond. But that discussion took place in 2007. And things actually changed a bit in 2008 with the election of the KMT president in Taiwan. And it was interesting for me, I'm not a regular visitor to Taiwan, and unlike these my co-panelists, I'm not nearly as expert. I kind of dip in and out of the issue. So it was interesting for me to go back to Taiwan during the Ma Ying-jeou presidency, and it was quite revelatory because I hadn't been since the mid-90s. And you have suddenly had this dense network of ties between the mainland and Taiwan, which had just not existed before. Suddenly you had the flights were allowed, people were going backwards and forwards, there were loads of mainland tourists, and it looked like actually there was a real rapprochement going on, and that this kind of war talk that you've seen in 96 and that then I've witnessed again in Beijing in 2007 suddenly seemed kind of irrelevant. And you thought, oh, you know, globalization in action, and you know, economics and business is trumping all these, unfortunate word, but it appears to be more important than these strategic rivalries. But again, it changes in 2016 with two things. Maybe three. 2016, you get Tsai Ing-wen elected in Taiwan, Trump elected in the US, but also in the background, you've had, I think, an increasingly assertive mainland government under Xi Jinping, which is suddenly seems a bit more impatient about the whole Taiwan issue. Now, whether that's because they, in their minds, are reacting to the reemergence of the DPP in Taiwan, or whether it's to do, as my reading of it is, it's also to do with Xi's whole pitch to the Chinese nation about the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people, and this is about completing the kind of historic mission of the CCP to unite the country. And but he seems more impatient, the Taiwanese seem more assertive, and you have this wild card suddenly in the White House. And that's the, you know, I think probably, you know, we heard in the previous statements that in some ways the positions of the mainland and Taiwanese are relatively predictable. What is unpredictable is how is Trump going to play this if there's a crisis. One of the first things he did before he even took the Oval Office was to have this phone call with Tsai Ing-wen, which I think had a lot of people very jittery quite quickly, and they thought, oh, my goodness, there's going to be a real crisis quite soon. But then the Americans dialed it down. They were I think, as far as I remember, the Chinese said there would be no call between Xi Jinping and Trump until the Americans restated the traditional position on Taiwan, which they then did. And my reading of what's going on inside the American government is that, as ever, there's a division between the specialists who take the Taiwan issue very seriously, and a sense that Trump's view of China is very much trade-driven. He's not really, despite the bellicose noises he made over Korea and his willingness to threaten military force in that case, he's not actually somebody who's particularly interested in military engagements in Asia. What he wants to do is to correct the trade deficit. So there must be a concern in Taiwan that in the event of a crisis, Trump will prioritize his relations with Beijing, his relations with Xi Jinping, particularly if he sees the prospect of a trade deal. And the Taiwanese security, which was kept very separate from the trade issue, could become part of some kind of grand bargain in a way that would be rather unpredictable. There are, however, voices around Trump. I mean, John Bolton was one, but he's gone now, who were very strongly pro-Taiwan. But I think Matt Pottinger, who was the Asia guy in the National Security Council and is now the number two in the National Security Council, and appears to be the great survivor of the Trump White House, he's the only one I can think of who's still in place from the beginning. He's he's a China hawk, essentially, and I think somebody who would take Taiwanese security and the issue of the cops in Taiwan very seriously, so we'll put pressure on the president to try to stand up to that, but who knows what Trump will do in crisis, and even his closest advisors know that. So that's the position we're in. How would China react, how would Beijing react to a re-election of Tsai Ing-wen? Now, my guess is that there would be, as ever, kind of scary rhetoric, but not much action beyond an intensification of the policy that we've already seen. But obviously, Xi Jinping is also under a variety of different pressures. And I think that the situation in Hong Kong is a kind of wild card now, because if he appears to be losing control of Hong Kong, then I think his nationalist credentials at home are under threat. And therefore, he might feel under greater pressure to be seen to be touched with Taiwan. It's just a supposition, but if you try to think, unless his position is completely secure, which seems to me unlikely for any leader really, then he can't really afford another big setback in terms of this project of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people. So he may feel that he needs to be harsher with Taiwan. It's certainly a risk. But my guess is that the gentleman to my left or right, and that it's slightly more likely that you will have a status quo situation. But as I say, the Hong Kong challenge is enormous for him, and it will has to affect the way that he thinks about Taiwan. However, just to come back before I finish to the sort of historical picture, if you like. If you think back to the Taiwan Straits crisis in 1995-96, it's clear that we've had a series of potential flashpoints, particularly between the US and China, built around this general sense of the rise of China and the question of how long American hegemony in the Pacific can last. And that's really, I think, the big strategic question of the 21st century. You had the Taiwan Straits crisis then, but then you had other crises around other regions. In 2012, 2013, there was a lot of tension around the Senkaku Islands, between Japan and China, the risk that the US would get dragged into that. Then, more recently, you had a lot of tension around the South China Sea, the building of military bases by the Chinese in the middle of the sea, the increase in American naval patrols. And each of those issues actually briefly seemed to be more important or more viable as a platform between China and America than Taiwan. Now we may see Hong Kong coming up the agenda and how the United States is going to react to that. But it's in a way, Taiwan is the oldest of these issues, and it's the one that keeps coming back. And I think it's not at all unlikely that Taiwan will become, once again, the tensest issue in U.S.-Chinese relations. But it's part of a continuum
from trade to the South China Sea to the relationship with Japan, and they all kind of interconnect, and that's combined with the unpredictability of Trump, something that makes this a tense and probably pretty unpredictable period. So I'll leave it there for now. I'm happy to continue the discussion.
Great. You can keep your mic on, I think.
Okay, do these,
do these work?
Yeah, you do.
Okay. So I've been asked to kind of start the discussion. And I guess I have some questions of my own that I'd like to ask, because these are things that I've been thinking about for a while. It's like, wow, I've got three experts here. I should take advantage of it. First one was sort of alluded to, and it's how well does Beijing or the leaders, and how well do the leaders in Beijing really understand Taiwan? Do they study it, or the sort of the Taiwan, you know, so I'm a China studies geek. Are there Taiwan studies geeks in Beijing and Shanghai or, you know, Fujian who really deeply understand Taiwan? Or is it the problem that Beijing is sometimes believing its own propaganda about Taiwan, which is one of the stories coming out of the Hong Kong elections, is that Hong Kong elections were a huge surprise in Beijing because they didn't do the work to try and understand people who may or may not agree with them. So I'll start with Chris on that, and then we'll just go around.
Yeah, well, I think there are. I mean, there's a lot of people going from mainland China to Taiwan to do research. So I said one problem is they tend to talk to one side, and there's, I guess, an inbuilt self-censorship issue there. Having said that, there are some good experts. As you mentioned, some of them are in Fujian in particular, a long way from Beijing. And that's another problem, because Taiwan watching became an industry. And so there's all kinds of think tanks. And there has been some quite good work done on these think tanks and showing how the ones in Beijing tend to know less about Taiwan than the ones in Fujian, you know. But the ones in Beijing, obviously, are the ones who have a louder voice, and they're attached to the military or the security and so on. So there's a sort of structural problem there, which is made worse by a leader like Xi Jinping, who, of course, you know, the problem with any strong leader is people don't want to challenge them. And this is a problem for him across all policy areas, that he's surrounded, it seems, by yes men. Otherwise, how do we explain Hong Kong and the appalling situation there that he should easily have known about? But he didn't, it seems. He also purged the Taiwan Affairs Office after they got it wrong with the election of Tsai Ing-wen. So that was part of his purges. But I don't, you know, when you purge people for getting it wrong, it's not going to make them perform better. They're kind of living in fear, you know, of saying the wrong thing. So I think it's a problem of policy making in China across the board at the moment, of an increasingly authoritarian leader that people are afraid to challenge. And that's made worse by the sort of structure of the Taiwan research think tanks and so on, how they've developed over the last 20 years or so.
I broadly agree with what Chris has just said. I think the problem in China actually goes deeper than the current authoritarian leader. As an ex-civil servant myself, the tendency to like groupthink, where everybody thinks the same way, everybody ends up telling the people above them what they think they want to hear, not be underestimated. And in this context, putting Taiwan into sort of foreign policy, which Chinese would excoriate me for, but actually it's not just the Taiwan Affairs Office. If you look at the Chinese Foreign Ministry, it's a very weak ministry. China basically isn't interested in foreign policy. When did you last see somebody who dealt with foreign affairs in the Politburo? And the same is true even more so of the Taiwan Affairs Office. By and large, ambitious Chinese civil servants, party members, don't want to end up in the Taiwan Affairs Office. They don't see it as a career-enhancing path. So you get media bureaucrats in the office in the first place. And a number of anecdotal examples of what's happened as a result of that. And actually, though, perhaps the best example I've heard of
this is anecdotal, I may put it wrong, but I was told on good authority that the Taiwan Affairs Office had actually advised Xi Jinping not to meet Ma Ying-jeou in Singapore ahead of the last election because it was too risky. And this is the default position, don't take a risk. And that's the classic bureaucratic position. So stick with the status quo, we know that. Xi Jinping ignored them, he overturned them. What was the outcome? It did not achieve China's objectives. So he's not publicly going to say he was wrong, he purges the TAO, but it just reinforces the inclination to be cautious and not to take any initiatives and not to try to understand Taiwan.
Just a quick thought. I'm just interested in the almost ideological challenge that is posed by, specist sentiment, as it would be described in Hong Kong and Taiwan, because the official line, as I understand it, is that, you know, there's just one Chinese people, their natural destiny is to be reunited. And if you're confronted with evidence that actually a lot of your compatriots in Hong Kong and Taiwan do not want this, how do you explain this? Now, the easy explanation is, well, it's foreign interference, etc. You've heard quite a lot of that in Hong Kong, but when you have an election and large numbers do not opt for that, I think it's almost a sort of thought puzzle for how do you square this, the claims of the ideology with what's actually happened.
Okay, I have one other question. It's about the military. So listening to the panel, I was thinking, you know, to ask the question again, is there going to be a war? And what is, does, I guess from listening to the presentations, I was thinking, oh my gosh, it's only the U.S. military that's standing between the PLA and Taiwan. And I guess I'll just put it like that. Is that true? Or is it, because it seems like the political solution from Beijing's point of view is not working, and what is left? Isolation and the military solution. So please tell me that I'm exaggerating and getting it all wrong.
Well, none of us know, but because of it's a secret, and they probably, you know, won't, you know, they'll have, like any military and any political leadership, a bunch of options. One of which clearly will be to invade Taiwan. But whether they'll actually make that decision, you know, in the end, seems in some ways implausible. I mean, of course. The US military is incredibly important to the balance of power. But I think that one thing we've learned, it's probably a bit early to say that from the Hong Kong crisis, but an early interpretation of the Hong Kong crisis is that Beijing has been more cautious than people realize. You know, there was a lot of talk early on in the, you know, from June onwards that you'd have PLA troops on the streets of Hong Kong very quickly. But I think the Chinese government has been appropriately cautious in realizing that they could get bogged down in urban warfare. Why would they want to do that? However unsatisfactory the situation, better to play it along. I mean, I may be proved totally wrong and they, you know, the troops show up in 2 weeks' time. But that's the way it looks for now. And if you extrapolate that to Taiwan, it might be that there's a lot of scary talk intended to intimidate Washington and Taipei, but actually they're not mad. You know, and it's a very even, given the difficulty, the preponderance of forces, even if they were taking on just Taiwan, having an invasion across that strait, managing the landing, suppressing the Taiwanese forces, suppressing the population, it would be crazy. It would, you know, and it would destroy their relations with the rest of the Western world, therefore the basis of their economy, or the economic miracle. So it would be an enormous step for them to take. So I'm not sure that, however nationalistic the rhetoric, that the Chinese leadership is that rhetoric.
Thank you. Want to add?
Well, I would agree. And first of all, don't underestimate the importance that Chinese leadership attaches to Sun Tzu, the art of war. It's been around a long time, but all the Chinese leaders still read it and take heed of it. An invasion would basically be the mission of defeat. And although everybody tends to see this in terms of US, China, Taiwan, the reality is that actually an invasion of Taiwan wouldn't just be about that, bad enough though that would be. It affects Japan, it affects Korea, it affects the relationship on the Korean Peninsula, Well, let's not forget that the reason the US supported Taiwan for so long was following Mao's invasion of Korea. So the Chinese, the rhetoric will continue, the rhetoric might step up. Xi, or whoever's in power, might have to be used to the military in terms of something like an anti-secession law to keep them happy. But setting aside all that, just the logistical challenges of shipping enough troops over 100 miles of ocean, providing the backup facilities for them to launch a credible assault, should not be underestimated.
Well, you know, in a rational world, there would have been no wars. And the Japanese would never have attacked Pearl Harbor because it was suicidal. They knew that, you know, the Japanese high command knew that. But military politics is more complex when the military get involved in politics. So, because we're in danger of all agreeing here, so I would strike a note of caution, building on the concern about Washington and a lack of discipline in Washington, which is chronic, and it leaves massive space for miscalculations, bad signaling, as I said, with North Korea nearly came to nuclear war. But on the Chinese side, you know, the issue has been raised about how strong is Xi's leadership. There are big questions over that. I wouldn't want to exaggerate it, but it's not unimaginable to think that the military get more politicized, more involved in politics when the party leadership is weak and divided. We've seen this throughout the history of the PRC. And if we are coming into that kind of period with an economic crisis, maybe rising prices in particular, inflation or something, lack of leadership legitimacy, division in the party where the military needs to make its stake, its claim to power, then you're in the kind of situation that you saw maybe in Germany in 1914, in Japan in 1941, and then it's all very different. And so that's why I said in my comments, the one note of caution I would strike is, you know, if something substantial changes inside the PRC, and we are in a very uncertain period now with the PRC and in Washington, and that's bad. And when the Taiwanese studied their elections in 1996, they were very clever because they made sure that they coincided with the American electoral cycle. So, you know, it's always in the same year as an American election year. Now, that makes sense because there's always got a China bashing in the US elections. And so the Taiwanese election will be held in the middle of all this China bashing. They'd get a lot of support. But if that is happening in the context of Trump's election campaign, where, you know, China bashing is becoming, like, you know, really provocative and serious, and there's a lot of jostling for power and so on, and different voices coming out, total lack of discipline. Then, you know, if you have that in two sides of the three of the triangle, that's really, I think, the recipe for a very high risk situation, and the Taiwanese need to be very careful how they play.
Okay, so now we'll open up to questions from the audience. See, right here, please wait for the microphone. Can you identify yourself? Try and make your questions short.
Can I ask two questions?
No.
So my name is Eva Matteo. I'm a student at SOAS. And my question is, you all said that the Hong Kong situation will have an impact on Taiwanese elections, but how did actually change the rhetoric among Taiwanese politicians and people about the Hong Kong situation and the cross-strait relations after that revolts began?
Why don't we actually gather three questions in the back there, trying to make the steward work.
My name is Philip. First of all, thank you for the insights that you gave. I'm also a graduate student here at the LSE. And my question is on the cross-strait policies. To what extent does the cross-strait policy of Han Kuo-yu differ from previous KMT presidents?
Okay. And Kendrick up front. He's one of my students, so I know who he is. But you can still say your name.
My name is Kendrick. I'm a master's student in international relations here at LSE. My question is that, do you think the current status quo is the best way for Taiwan going forward? And if so, you know, how long can they continue this? Is it in perpetuity?
So, three questions answered. Does anyone want to jump in? Gideon?
Well, I'll try the last one, although the others may also have views on it. Yeah, I mean, I think that the status quo has worked quite well for Taiwan. I mean, obviously, the country has managed to become prosperous, developed, and to develop its political system, become a democracy under what looks like the most threatening of external environments and a constant effort by the PRC to isolate them. In fact, a slightly bizarre way, when I look at Brexit Britain, I sort of take some encouragement from Taiwan because I think, you know, we can't be more isolated than them, and they may be. So, you know, Taiwan is an incredibly resilient place. And if they can maintain the status quo, I think it's probably maintainable with all the qualifications that we've spelt out. That's probably as good as it's going to get for a while. I mean, the only other thing that would really change it is big political changes in mainland China, but that doesn't seem on the horizon at the moment.
Okay, cross-straits policy of Han Guoyu. Anyone want to?
Well, there were two questions that were related. One was about the student when you said that, actually, Han Guoyu also came into my mind because, you know, with Tsai Ing-wen, her rhetoric has become much tougher against China. But that's not just because of Hong Kong. It had already begun when China was taking away these diplomatic allies. And she was getting credit in the opinion polls for being much more defiant and tougher and defiant towards China. So when the Hong Kong thing began, she has been really done a number of things. Some of it is rhetorical, and she gave a speech just I think a couple of days ago where she was talking about the security of Taiwan as her priority. That's going to be the theme of her campaign. But also the practical issues of, you know, inviting the Hong Kong students to come to Taiwan, Hong Kong dissidents, publishers, and so on, and really making it a kind of refuge for them. So there's a lot going on there. And then I think that puts Hong Kong, puts Han Guoyu in a very difficult position because he cannot ignore Hong Kong. And, you know, that's one country, two systems in practice. Now, no one's ever accepted that in Taiwan, including the KMT, but that's the future for Taiwan if they kind of move towards China. That's how it seems. So what's interesting about Han Guoyu is, you know, I noticed, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you know better, but one of the initiatives or a lot of previous KMT presidential candidates has been to say they're going to sign a peace agreement with China. Now, that's been very controversial in Taiwan for many reasons, and I noticed Han Guoyu recently distanced himself from that in a speech and said he's not going to go down that route. And I think that's a significant move, which again indicates that the way that the DPP are being kind of forced away from this overtures towards China. And that's really something that Beijing needs to worry about more than anything.
I think Chris has pretty well done it all. But certainly on Han Guoyu, just to add, the difficulty he faces compared to, say, the last KMT administration is that, as Chris has said, actually, under Tsai Ing-wen, who really has followed a pretty pragmatic and very essentially moderate policy, which apart from the economic issues, it has had broad support in public opinion in terms of handling China. So the difficulty for Han Guoyu is how does he create a pro-China policy that doesn't look as if it's just basically kowtowing to China. With Ma Ying-jeou, it was much easier because, unlike now, actually, the DPP administration of Chen Shui-bian had had quite intensive talks with the PRC. And Ma's immediate sort of low-hanging fruit success in the direct flights had actually been negotiated and agreed by the DPP. But the Chinese said, we're not going to announce this side of the election because we don't want to give you an election boost. So Ma got the benefit. But Ma was, in his first administration, bipartisan. He brought in, as his mainland affairs chair, actually somebody who was a deep green politician. He wanted to show that he was reaching out to all Taiwanese. He had a very clearly stated policy that was to seek a trade agreement in his first term. He achieved that. Han Kuo-yu, his problem is, how can he offer something rhetoric, something credible, something concrete that will appeal to the Taiwanese and the Chinese are prepared to go along with? And at the moment, there's very little he can offer. So all he's got is the rhetoric. As Chris says, every day that you have problems in Hong Kong, he's got to try to roll back on the pro-China rhetoric, because every day you see more protests in Hong Kong, so anti-China feeling in Taiwan grows that much stronger.
Actually, I got to jump in. Whatever happened to independence? If the DPP is going to win, you know, isn't there a substantial group that wants independence to push it that way? And how would the DPP manage that?
I think with Taiwan, we should stop using the word independence, because it doesn't actually mean very much. What we're talking about is recognition, degrees of diplomatic recognition, because, you know, we all know Taiwan is a de facto independent state, which enjoys all kinds of relationships. The issue is what degree of recognition it can achieve. And the DPP's platform is that Taiwan is already an independent state, doesn't need to declare independence, and that's worked fairly well for it in terms of the electoral dynamics. So I don't think there's a strong move away from that. But however, as I said, Tsai Ing-wen's running, vice presidential running mate, Lai Ching-te, is much more on the pro-independence, sort of taking a harder line on achieving more recognition, we should say, pushing harder for recognition, pushing the envelope in those organisations that Michael was talking about, for example, the CPTPP or whatever it is now, you know, the World Health Organization, which upsets Beijing. But that's a kind of internal debate in the DPP. How far do you go towards pushing for greater recognition before you you upset Washington, really, not Beijing, is the key thing, which Chen Shui-bian found out, of course, when he went too far and George Bush slapped him down.
I don't mean to add to that, but they still remember the lesson from Chen Shui-bian in relation to Washington.
Yeah. Okay. But again, we don't have that.
Yeah. Okay, so you?
Oh,
right in front. Would you please wait for the microphone?
Thank you for the panel. I'm a Hong Konger working. Then I have two questions. There has been speculation. There has been some speculation about the KMT would move to alliance of Wang Jinping, Guo Taiming, and what's it called, Ko Wen-je. It probably doesn't materialize this time, but would these three figures gain more influence over the KMT in the future? And the second point.
Okay, thank you.
No, I really want to ask this. Nobody have touched upon the possibility of.
Come on, discipline. Where's your job for you? Someone back there wanted to ask a question? Yes.
Strong leadership.
Thank you. I'm student from LSE, and my question is, why China cares so much about Taiwan? Like, is it about substantial benefit, like territory or economic benefits, or it's more of a symbolic benefit, like for its own, like China, like whole China unification dream? Or I heard the saying that the CCP has been telling their people that, like, how to say, about the prospect of the whole China reunification. So now, after a long time, CPP just cannot let go of the saying, so it keeps hold on Taiwan. But, I mean, my question is, like, what's the real benefits for it if it really have Taiwan? Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, could I just... What was the question? What would be the benefits for China if it had Taiwan?
Why do they care? And right here,
questions.
Yeah.
Thank you for your insights. I'm a
exchange student from the U.S., Taiwanese citizen. My question is, with the U.S. election also coming up, if there is a change of administration, what do you perceive is the change of U.S. stance toward Taiwan and taking into account that the trade war might be mitigated and how that will affect U.S., China, and Taiwan relation?
Okay. So anyone want to jump in?
On the co-enter issue, I mean, previous mayor of Taipei, he's set up his own party now, right? The Taiwan People's Party, which goes back to that issue I was talking about, that, you know, if the two parties are neck and neck in the parliamentary elections, then those small parties could be hold the balance of power. And that's, so it's kind of a smart move of those people. I'm not quite sure what they'll do with that. Which is really a call of your question, but it would give them ability to probably moderate the policies of the DPP if it went towards the Lai Ching-de direction, possibly. But you know, but they have set up this small party, the Taiwan People's Party, which could hold a big part of the balance of power. I think on why does China care about Taiwan, I have my own anecdote here. A conference some years ago in the US where there was a very high-ranking PLA officer, a woman actually, who gave a very quite interesting presentation on their military strategy and so on. And there was a young Taiwanese student in the front row who said, "Please tell me why you care about Taiwan." Yes, and she really didn't know what to say. She was kind of
well, it's ours.
In the end, she said, "It's a psychological complex." And it is, you know. I mean, you know, practically, if Taiwan was independent, they'd have a great relationship with China and possibly even form a federation or something if they weren't under duress, you know. And it's just, it is a psychological issue that goes to the core of Chinese nationalism and is perpetuated and reinforced through the propaganda, then it gets caught up in factual politics as an issue of legitimacy. So, you know, that's the answer. I'll leave the other ones in the US.
Well, just to add two points on both those two. Wang Jinping, Guo Chaimin, and the rest of it. Chris, in his presentation, talked about the DPP being a sort of group of all these factions. I think we too often tend to assume that the KMT, because it's got this very clear, if you like, sort of quote, pro-China, unquote, position, that the KMT is a homogeneous party. The KMT is actually about as homogeneous as the Conservative Party is in the UK, or at least it was a few weeks ago. Wang Jinping is head of one particular faction. He has long held his own presidential ambitions. He accepts he's not going to get those because of all sorts of skeletons in the cupboard and other factors. On the other hand, there are around Han Kuo-yu people, senior people within the party, who, when you talk to them privately, they've got a pretty low opinion of Han Kuo-yu. They support him because they feel that he's the leader. Their position, their influence will be enhanced accordingly. And so essentially what you're looking at here, I think, is a far from new internal fight within the KMT over leadership, over direction, and so on. What the outcome will be, well, my own feeling is Guo Taimin has actually largely lost enthusiasm for running for president. As Chris says, Kowinder has set up his own party. Wang Jinping, I think at the end of the day, will stay in the KMT. He's talked about leaving before. He talked when Mark was their presidential candidate, that he said, look, the KMT should be only Taiwanese, and should make it clear, because Ma, of course, was born in Hong Kong. It came to nothing. Ma tried to have him prosecuted and ejected, all the rest of it. On why does China care about Taiwan? I mean, again, I would endorse what Chris says. I would add to it that China never used to care about Taiwan. Mao Zedong is on the record as saying that Taiwan should be independent. And he only started caring about Taiwan when Chiang Kai-shek fled there. And it's a psychological complex because it's unfinished business from the Chinese Civil War. This Communist Party won't feel they have completely won until they have finally vanquished the remnants of sort of the Chiang Kai-shek people sort of see it. It's crazy, it's absurd, you know, it's out of date, but as Chris said, it's a psychological complex. And I agree with him. It's something on which I'd agree with the PLA. And Chris is right. If Taiwan was actually independent, because of a peace agreement, Taiwan would probably agree to actually China having a military base on the island. You know, change of US administration. I don't see that at present affecting US-Taiwan relations. Certainly not if Tsai Ing-wen is re-elected. She's got a very good relationship with Washington, as is the Foreign Secretary Joseph Wu, and with the Democrats as well as with the Republicans, although generally the Taiwanese tend to feel more comfortable with Republican administrations, despite the fact it was Nixon and Kissinger who prepared to sell them down the river. Would it affect the trade war? Bizarrely, perhaps, this is something on which there is broadly bipartisan support. The Democrats, if anything, are criticizing Trump for not going hard enough on China. A lot of that is campaign rhetoric. I would expect some rolling back, but because of there is such bipartisan support for a hawkish line on China, I don't actually see any major change, at least not in the short term.
Just briefly, I agree with what some of my colleagues have said about why they care. I mean, I'll just add one element is that it seems to me that the narrative that Xi in particular has pushed is to raise up this whole idea of the century of humiliation and his mission and the CCP's mission to reverse that and restore China's standing. And Taiwan has been incorporated into that story of foreign interference, of humiliations inflicted on China. Now, that's a highly disputable narrative of the way in which Taiwan fits into that, but it's been made a central part of it. So I think it's portrayed almost as the completion of the return of China to respect. I mean, again, we've all had these slightly bizarre conversations with Chinese officials about, well, why do you care? I remember one, again, 20 years ago, talking to somebody who was saying we would invade, etc. And I was trying to make the case that maybe that wasn't the best way of doing it. And said, look, you know, if Scotland voted to be independent, I wouldn't be happy about it, but, you know, they can be independent. And he said, I just don't believe that. And I said, well, what do you think we're doing? He said, you'll invade. At that point, I sort of gave up. Catalonia, exactly. I mean, nationalism is the Spanish mind, actually, fighting that. On the US, I think it's really interesting how this plays in. I mean, I think Chris said we're in an era of China bashing and that would potentially strengthen Taiwan's position. But I think it's more complex than that because I think the China bashing, it's clear that there's been a bipartisan change in mood in Washington. It's not just Trump who says the engagement policy has failed. The Democrats say that too. And there is also bipartisan backing for a trade war and trying to correct all that. However, I think there's another strand of opinion, which is also fairly bipartisan, which is a kind of growing isolationism, a sense that America is no longer really up for foreign wars, certainly not in the Middle East, but that this expansive forward position with bases all over the world is something that they've inherited, okay, fine, but whether that's actually a commitment to fight it's taken as gospel by the group that Obama's officials labeled the blob, the Washington establishment. But whether there's a support for that out in the country, I'm not sure is that clear. And that may become clearer that the Dems are also moving in a slightly more isolationist way. I mean, certainly I think that's where Sanders and Warren would be. So it's kind of ambiguous where America would stand on this question of how far they would go to support Taiwan. And there are, strategists who believe that in the end, if there was a confrontation, America wouldn't fight, and that would kind of mark a symbolic moment of transfer of power or dominance of the Pacific. Now, I don't believe, if the Americans can, they will avoid having a moment that clear cut, a sort of reversal of the Taiwan Straits crisis. And we'll all be a bit unlucky if it ever gets to a confrontation that is that stark. But I think there is a question mark over whether the Americans would ultimately confront China over Taiwan.
Well, actually, I want to thank the panelists. We are out of time, sadly. So please, before we thank them, I should remind you to fill out your questionnaire and be honest in telling us how great this was. So I thank our panelists.